I think we're going to get ready to start the second session. Okay, I think we got enough people here to get ready to begin. Hope you enjoyed that demo session. We're going to start the second session of this conference. My name is Heath Nielsen. I'm an employee of the Family History Department of the church. This session looks like we're going to be focusing on records, search, and extraction. And our first presentation today will be given by Oliver Nina, discussing thresholding of text documents using recursion of the Otsu algorithm.
Let's see, I need to load this. Good morning, everyone. My name is Oliver Nina. I'm originally from Peru. I'm a student here at BYU, computer science student. Doing the master's program, and I just need to load this presentation. So it's my first time here at this technology workshop, and this is my first time as a spectator and as a presenter. But it's great to see so many people interested in technology and so many people to see interested in technology and family history. I got to see some people from other countries like Sweden. I'm from Peru, and some people from the foreign land of Salt Lake as well. So it's great to be here. Okay, so what I'm going to present to you guys, and I need to get this right. I think this is the one. Maybe that one. It's kind of out of angle. Okay. So it's a new thresholding algorithm for text documents. Along with Dr. Berg, we are working still on the algorithm, but I'm going to show to you today great results on the progress. So what is thresholding or binarization? It's a simple method of image segmentation. So we see a picture here and the histogram. The histogram is the pixels and the picture. And when we apply thresholding to the image, we want to separate the image into two parts, the foreground or the background. In this case, I call it the object of interest. So if we apply a thresholding on this image right here, and if we say, okay, in this point, I want everything on this side to be background and everything on this side to be foreground. That's how we divide the image into two separate things. Okay, so why is thresholding important? Thresholding is important because we need to separate the image in order to process them. In the case of microfilms, we threshold them in order to send them to OCR, optical character recognition. We want to recognize the characters in the text. So that's why we need thresholding. So as we can see in this image, we've got an image on the left with a lot of text, but we see some noise in the image, so we want to threshold that, and the result is what we see on the right. So what's the problem with thresholding? Well, typical algorithms do a fairly well job on thresholding images. However, it is harder when the text looks exactly like the background. So as in this image, we can appreciate that some strokes are very soft. So as we apply a threshold algorithm, we're going to lose some of them, as we can see here. So we want to improve this. I'm going to explain some of the previous work that has been done in thresholding. There are different kinds of thresholding. We can classify them into global thresholding, which could be divided into bimodal, multimodal, multispectral. Also, we have adaptive or local thresholding, which could be divided into hierarchical data structures or small window. So these techniques have different advantages and disadvantages. For instance, the global thresholding picks one general value for the whole image. So sometimes it's good because it's fast to calculate, but in an image that is not uniform, then it's not good because it loses some of the pixels. Adaptive threshold, on the other hand, is better into localizing subimages and applying thresholding to them, but it doesn't run fast, and there are other issues with those. So I'm going to give some examples of those thresholding algorithms. We have the mean or the median value. We have iterative methods. We have k-means, Otsu, Nyblack, Janowitzen, Broxton. These are popular examples of thresholding algorithms. So I'm going to explain to you guys a new method of using the Otsu algorithm with recursion. There is a similar work cited in a paper of June 1998 by Sherrod Sett and Soon. They used that method in thresholding text from bank checks. So they used a training set to train the background of the checks and remove that. But it only works when the targeted value is the darkest value in the image. So our approach. So we first do an estimation of the background. We do that by doing a medium filter. Then we subtract the background. We got this from Hutchinson, 2004. We subtract that. And then we apply Otsu iteratively in the different parts of the histogram. And the end result is adding together all those parts. And we can see the original there. So how do we estimate the background? So first we apply a median filter with a kernel of radius 21 or bigger. When we do that, we end up with an image similar to background. We subtract the background and then normalize the histogram. So when I subtract the background of that original, it's going to give me something like that. But as I normalize it, it gives me a more legible image. And then finally, we apply Otsu. But what is Otsu? The Otsu algorithm has the goal to minimize the within variance class. So my first attempt, this is the histogram, the grayscale. My first attempt to find the threshold of the histogram is there, but we see that the within variance is not minimal yet. So this is the second attempt. And we finally find the optimal threshold where the within variance in each cluster, because Otsu divides the histogram in two clusters. So in each cluster, the within variance is minimal. So mathematically, what that means is that the within variance is a weighted sum of the variance in each cluster. So for you guys that are mathematical, there is the formula. So Calculating the within-class variance is sometimes too expensive. What we want to do is something faster, and for that, we instead of calculating the within-class variance, we maximize the between-class variance. So when we minimize the within-class variance, we maximize the between-class variance because the total variance is constant. So those two terms are the same thing. So this is what Atsu does, and these are the results. But as you can see, we're still missing some strokes. So we came up with a new approach to it, to Atsu, called RATSU, recursive Atsu. And this is the algorithm. We apply Atsu the first time and threshold the image with that threshold. And we apply Atsu multiple times until we run out of pixels or there is no more pixels to process. So if we see that in a histogram, this is the original histogram, and every time we're applying Atsu, we're cutting part of the histogram. So we are eliminating the background ending up with the software structs. So these are the results. On top is the original image, and here is on the bottom is the original image with the background subtracted. So this is the first set of pixels we get from the first threshold. We can apply that multiple times to the remaining of the pixels, and every time we're getting different parts of the image. And at the end, we combine them all, and we get the text. This is another image. Similar results. This is a Spanish, I believe, record. A scan as well, and we're approximating the background and then doing threshold on the pixels. This is a little bit, it's another image, but it's a little bit harder to process because of the background. So for that, we use the background removal, which works really nice. And as you can see on the left side, we have the image with the background removed. This is in iteration 3 or 4, and we're gonna end up with the total image, the sum of the parts. Finally, this is an image taken from the Harold Lee Library archive. These are JPEG images. So we have applied RATSU on the result as well. However, as we take a close look at the text, we see that there are some JPEG artifacts in the image that get introduced when we save those images in JPEG format. So if we take a close look at the final result, we're getting those artifacts in the image. So what we say to that is no JPEG for handwriting images. And that's the end of the presentation. The conclusion, although RATSU is a work in progress, it definitely shows promising results. RATSU allows to save software structs that would be lost with conventional methods. It's relatively easy to implement and opens up the door to new ideas on how to improve thresholding. So something that we want to work on and get better at is determining the better background. Right now we're using a kernel of 21, or sometimes it's bigger, 41. So we want to automate that. We're going to automate the medium filter and also improve other criteria on how to choose which part of the histogram. And we also want to combine them with other methods that have been developed before to improve on it. So is there any questions?
There's no method where you can say, I mean, when you drive a pen, you usually don't lift the pen very often. So the pixels should sort of follow each other. Is there no way to get that into the model so that you can remove all the unnecessary dots that sometimes pop up in pictures?
Yes, you could do that with some local thresholding algorithms. Oh, some people didn't hear your question, so. So what he's asking is sometimes people write things that we don't want in the picture, right? Is that what he asked?
No, that the pen stroke is more than one stroke. I mean, you don't lift the pen when you write.
So the noise is isolated, and maybe you, rather than connected, like pen strokes, and so therefore maybe you could use that to get rid of the noise, the pepper.
Yes. We try to do that with GraphCut, and so there might be other ways to improve that and take advantage of that characteristic that handwriting has. So, is there any other questions?
Is it for all images or just very light images? Is it for any image, any historical old handwriting?
Yes. We focus on scan microfilms and text images because that's our priority, but you could use this thresholding algorithm for anything you want. Like, it might work very well for other cases as well. So if there is no other questions, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Oliver. As we're getting set up for the next presentation, we'll be listening to a presentation given by Stephen Ivey and Haven Gettrell, I believe, on a metric-based learning machine approach to genealogical record linkage.
All right, well, while he's getting that set up, morning, everybody, or I guess I should, oh, it's not quite afternoon yet. Well, like you said, this is our presentation on what we call a metric-based machine learning approach with genealogical record linkage. Now, I'm under the impression, I haven't been to these workshops before, but I'm under the impression that record linkage is a concept that's been kind of introduced before, but just for those who, like me, haven't really been here, I think I'll just kind of go into it a little, just kind of try to explain a little bit as to what it is. We have a lot of databases in the world where we have a lot of duplicate individuals, or when we're trying to combine databases that have overlapping data, we can have a lot of individuals that may not necessarily have all the same data and attributes about them, but they actually refer to the same individual. And so that's what record linkage essentially is that process of determining whether or not two individuals with differing attributes, whether or not they actually refer to the same person. Now, this has a lot of applications in a lot of different fields today, but it especially has an application in genealogy, where when we have two pedigrees that we're putting together and we want to know, do two base pedigrees refer in actuality to the same person? Now, genealogical record linkage, or GRL as we've abbreviated it here, kind of differs from a lot of record linkage problems in a couple of ways. Record linkage typically deals with persons that have just a small number of attributes and that are pretty densely populated. But generally, when we're dealing with pedigrees, we have a large number of attributes, or we can have a lot of missing values or a lot of multiple values. So for example, someone may have numerous spouses because they remarried a few times, or they may have lots of children or lots of siblings, and all of these different persons that show up in their pedigree have their own attributes as well, and sometimes they aren't as sparsely populated either. They can have a lot of values that are missing. So I'm going to pass along this here.
Thanks, Evan. So basically, we can simplify the problem of genealogical record linkage to some basic data types. We need to be able to compare two names and discover how closely related they are to each other. We also need to be able to compare dates, like a birthday, and locations, and as well as gender. And then there's one more that we added on, a little bit more advanced comparison metric that we need to come up with, that Haven briefly mentioned, where we have one-to-many type comparisons, where we're comparing multiple children. So our approach is to do a metric-based genealogical record linkage program. And the goal is to make this fully automated machine learning approach that requires no human intervention. And each type of comparison, we're trying to reduce to some sort of similarity metric. So we come up with a score in each of those areas of how closely related they are. And this is an extension to our previous research that was done last year that used a structured neural net approach. And it shows promised results in both speed and accuracy and precision recall, which we'll talk about at the end. So first off, in order to evaluate which comparison metrics give us the best results, we evaluate it on four criteria. The first criteria is information gain. And information gain, we compare attributes on which one decreases the entropy and gives us the best result at the end. And then another comparison metric is accuracy, how accurate are we are at comparing these charts. And then a final comparison metric is F-score, which is both a combination of precision and recall. Essentially, that's your equivalence of false positives and false negatives. I'm trying to minimize those. So for name comparisons, basically in the industry, there's two types of name comparison metrics. There's ones that are phonetically based, and these are based off of sounds. And so if two names sound like each other, then they will score higher. And there's just some examples of some of the ones that are on the market. And then the second one is more of pattern matching, where they count how many substitutions you do, if an E is an A, or things like that. And there's some of the ones that we tried in the industry. The one that scored best on our metric, on our three different metrics, was an ensemble of Soundex, Starwinkler, Mong, Elkin, and Needleman and Wunsch. And so we took all the scores that were normalized between 0 and 1, and we averaged them, and that did best on our tests. And then the next type of comparison is a date comparison metric. And the first part of this metric, we just did a simple comparison of number of days difference between two dates. And then the second type of this, because we had so many null values where months were missing or days were missing, we also came up with a second type, which was a set, where it would mark whether it matched the before flag, the after flag, the about flag, or if it was within a range, and also help us deal with null values so we could just learn that rather than try to program it. And then the gender comparison was just really simple, a set of three. Either it matches, it doesn't match, or we don't know. And then for the location metric, the locations in our data set were heavily normalized, heavily standardized. They had been very well cleaned. And so every location was resolved to an actual location, whether it be present or past location. And so standard string comparisons were essentially rendered useless. We could say, yes, it matches, or no, it doesn't match. But other than that, it didn't make sense to compare strings any further It made no sense to compare the similarity between like Alaska and Alabama. They have characters but that score doesn't make any sense. And so we came up with a new metric system called geometrics. And so instead we used a physical location metric where we actually compare the physical distance between two points. And so just using the Yahoo API, we downloaded the coordinates and created a database to come up with that distance comparison. And it shows slightly higher sensitivity in different scenarios. One of the scenarios we noticed was sometimes there can be discrepancies in birthplace. Like, for example, I was born in the Provo Hospital, but my parents resided in Orem. And there's a common error where they'll enter in two different locations, one of the hospital, the actual birth location, and one where the parents reside. Or another example is they'll list the suburb, and one will list maybe the major city, like Salt Lake versus Sandy. And so those cases are where we get our biggest benefits. And the last thing about geometrics is it's kind of future friendly. Online, there's over four different of the major genealogy programs support the entering of longitude and latitude values. They do it frequently for grave sites or old homes. And so as time progresses, we get more of those locations. This metric would also improve. And then our last metric is our one-to-many comparisons, where we have a list of maybe three children over here and four children on this side, and we have to decide which ones to compare. And so we came up with a winner-take-all approach that the best comparison between two children becomes the result of all the children comparison. Or the same thing with spouses and siblings, et cetera. So the scores for the individuals were calculated by creating a neural net. We trained a neural net on just the base individual's data. And then we fed in mothers, fathers, siblings, and children data to come out with a confidence score from the neural net. And so for our original results, our methodology is we had a large data set from the church, about 15,000 names. And sets 1 and 2 were used for training, about 10,000 names. And then set 3 of about 5,000 names was used for testing. And originally we did a Clementine C 5.0 decision tree with boosting. And so as far as results, for accuracy, we were about 96.7. And then precision and recall balance between the two, we were around 93. And then this is a comparison of our previous work, which is the lowest line, our work, which is the next line, and then the church, their data. And so we're at this point, we're almost comparable with the church's system, but we're fully automated. The church relies on some handcrafted rules. And then we also do well on individual only. We're on the far side on that one as well. And then our latest results, we do a stacking game, and this is where we train 6 different classifiers. C5 is in there, neural net, a few others are in there. And then we take their output and send it into another neural net to train, and then that's our output. And our results on that were a little bit more improved. We had about 98.7% accuracy and about 95% precision recall compared with the 97% of the church. And so we have some promising avenues there. And so is there any questions that we can answer at this time? Yes, please. The different standard names. Yeah, there's two problems with the name comparison. One is where there's different variations of a name, where you actually do want to enter that into the database. Did everyone hear the question? Sorry, okay. the question that he asked was about the name comparison. Why don't we build a database of names? And it's a fabulous idea, but it only addresses one of two problems. With name comparisons, you run into two problems. There can be data entry errors where names are actually misspelled or misentered incorrectly. And then there's also name variations which you do want to include in the database. And so that would be good for future work to include that in there. But you would have to find the balance between those two. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. To actually match it. Yeah, with the Yahoo API, we only had about 95% of the locations that we were able to find. Oh, oops, I'm sorry. So the question was is that places, names of places change over time. And so we took a hit on that on our geometrics comparison because there's some places that Yahoo won't look up anymore, be it names of territories or cities that no longer exist. And so those would have to be manually entered. However, we were, in our data set, we were about 95% of getting actual geo-coordinates for the locations that we were getting. And the locations went clear back to the 1100s. So we still have a huge set of geo-coordinates that we were able to find, but you just have to take a hit on those or manually enter them on the locations that change over time. Yes, please. We would absolutely love to. The church graciously gave us their data set and would love, if we could get our hands on any other data set, would love to train on that and see what type of results we're getting. Yes, please.
What is the availability of the system?
Would love to make it open source. That's our plans within the next few months. Would love to make it open source. The data we can't make open source, but as far as the methodology and everything else, we can make open source. Yes, please. Yeah, the pedigree charts that we're comparing span three generations. It includes their children, themselves, their siblings, their spouse, and also their parents. And so it's three generations is the data set that we have. Is there any last
Anything
few questions?
Else? There?
Oh,
sorry. The program that we used, the question was, when we make it open source, what can we open source? We use Clementine, which is proprietary software, but we can output from Clementine the decision trees or the weights from the neural net, and so they can be easily put into Java to come out with a result. That'd be hard to change and retrain, but at least you could get results that way.
And there was a question over there.
Okay. So the question is on our location comparisons, how does comparing just the strings compare to comparing the physical locations? What we found in our data set is because all the locations were standardized to actual physical locations, that you could compare strings, but essentially it was just doing a Boolean value. Yes, it matches. No, it doesn't, when we looked at the resulting decision tree. And so when we added in the actual distance, on the cases that I mentioned, we increased our accuracy. And so overall, it was a little bit more accurate by comparing not just whether or not the location matched, but also distances. Guess, is there any other questions? Or one last one. Thank you.
I see that the data was heavily blocked.
Yes. Yes, we had a very clean database that was cleaned up and blocked by the church. We don't have access to their blocking algorithms. Our ratio for match to mismatch was about 1 to 3, so we had 3 mismatches to every match. It was very clean, and so a lot of the secret comes in the blocking algorithm.
Thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions?
Well, we sure appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Uh, Thank you for that presentation. Next, we just turn the time over to Doug Kennard, who will be talking on progress with searchable indexes for handwritten documents.
Okay. Last year at this workshop, we talked a little bit about some of the difficulties that arise in handwriting recognition. We also went over some of the various approaches that people have taken to handwriting recognition in the past. We mentioned that you can kind of break this up into different types of problems, and rather than trying to fully transcribe documents, you can kind of attack it from a different angle of searching for words in a document, which is an easier problem to solve. We also mentioned some work done by some researchers up at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst that provides Google-like search results on handwritten documents. And we talked about our desire to provide similar types of search engines for handwritten documents for the purposes of family history. So I won't spend too much time talking about difficulties in handwriting. What I'd like to do this year is go ahead and, last year at this point, most of what we had done was image pre-processing steps to prepare the data, and also some work on localizing the lines of text within pages automatically. This year I'd like to give you a status report of where we are now. I'll first talk a little bit about what we are currently doing for word separation within those lines of text. Word recognition, what we've done there. Also, interactive training to try to reduce the amount of training that's needed for handwriting recognition or search functionality. And then I'd like to show you a demo of the search system that we have so far, and then finally present a couple of suggestions of where these types of handwriting algorithms might be useful besides just search or transcription. Okay, first of all, word separation within lines of text. Some of the common approaches used by other people are blob analysis, looking for where words are by kind of blurring the image and trying to find then where the blobs are on the page. Another very common approach is to use gap metrics, where the connected components of the foreground text are then taken either as a bounding box around the connected component and then searching for the distance between the different components. An improved gap metric algorithm is to use the convex hull, or kind of this wrapping around the shape of a connected component. The work done by these two authors, whose names I don't know how to pronounce, are they take the centroid of each of the connected component areas within the convex hull, and then they calculate the distance as the distance where the line between the two centroids crosses the convex hull, which gives a better estimate of how close connected components are than a simple bounding box. What we're currently doing is we're trying to take the actual true distance between these convex hulls rather than just the simplified distance where the centroid lines cross. We expect to get a little bit of improvement on this, and that will give us kind of a baseline method that we can use to compare our future experimentation with as we try to improve word separation even more. What we're doing right now, in the meantime, since we don't have automatic word separation within lines working yet, is we've hand lassoed words manually, which is kind of a painstaking task. So what I show you from here on out in the presentation, keep that in mind, that we have basically perfect segmentation for the words that we're trying to recognize. Okay, so what we're doing with word recognition is based largely on work that has already been done by other researchers, again at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, primarily by Rath, Manmatha, and a couple of others. And the documents that you'll see throughout this presentation are George Washington Collection documents that were also provided from them or by them. What we do for word recognition is we pre-compute word level features. We're not trying to find letters within the words yet. We're taking features at the word level. We pre-compute matching costs between each of the words, and then we label some of the words as our training data to give examples of what images look like that correspond to actual words.